Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Paul Meyerberg of USA Today in just a few moments. But first, our play-by-play call of the day. Francisco Lindor at the plate. Another big night for him and the Indians.
Here's the pitch to Lindor. He swings and drives one. Another rocket deep to right center. Home run, Lindor. Oh, the kid's having a night tonight. It's a three-run bomb for Lindor. And the Indians are piling it on. It's now 9-2. Tribe in front.
And Indians finally won it 9-3, our play-by-play call of the day. Paul Meyerberg, college football writer, USA Today, joins us. Hi, Paul. Welcome. It's great to have you with us.
Yeah, great to be on the show. Thank you for having me.
All right, let's start with this. The Big Ten athletic directors got together, and when they did, they went through a usual variety of topics, but Sportsbook brings a new angle to everything in sports, and they at least sent a proposal to the NCAA loosely about, hey, look, maybe we should consider universal injury reports. When you saw that, what ran through your mind and what kind of model should they look at, the NFL or something else?
Well, the first thought, obviously, is that this is a good idea. I mean, it's a good idea on a number of different levels, but even if you just look at it through a gambling lens, I think it's important for the NCAA and certainly for its institutions to be at the forefront. And not necessarily in terms of condoning necessarily or even adopting their own rules and regulations regarding how or whether you can gamble on college sports, but just necessarily to align themselves into a position where the NCAA can make money on it, because that's what the NCAA does. That's all they really exist for. That's to make money for their member institutions. So I think an injury report is almost too logical to consider as you kind of envision a near future where college football gambling is prevalent in most states more often than not. But on a more game day level, what I thought about was, you know, this kind of evens the playing field, because that as it is, you have programs who don't even issue a depth chart like Michigan. Then you have programs like Northwestern that actually send out an injury report every Thursday. So I just thought that immediately it would even the playing field, make things more consistent, and also fit into the gambling theme. And yeah, I do think the NFL model would work best, which I believe on Fridays you get the final list of who's out and who's doubtful and who's, you know, projected to play.
When you saw Sportsbook to be expanded, right now you've got New Jersey, Delaware. They're in now, as is obviously Nevada, has been there for a long time. There could be, it's been 5 years, as many as 30 states doing this. In terms of the optics of integrity of the game, is an injury report a step in optics toward integrity?
I would think so. I mean, integrity-wise, I think the best thing the NCAA needs to do is really address the amateur model. And obviously that's the elephant in the room for the NCAA in terms of whether you pay players in general, this kind of lump sum, whether you allow name and likeness. I think that's the biggest step they'll take towards maintaining the integrity while also adopting and adapting to kind of a new culture we live in, a new society surrounding sports. But it would help. I mean, it is something that I'm not sure why college coaches or programs really feel the need to play this close to the vest, whether it's gamesmanship or something else. I just feel being open, talking about injuries is important for the sport in terms of player safety. It's a topic that we need to talk about in the media and also coaches. And just in general, being open about injuries is a good step towards making just injuries in general something that, you know, we consider more often in sports, especially this sport, because it is important to consider.
You mentioned Jim Harbaugh. He went through the NFL and had to report injuries every day all the time with the 49ers. Are you surprised with the tact he's taken in Michigan?
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised to a degree because it's so much worse and so beyond what you're seeing from other people. But knowing his personality a little bit, as we all tend to do, I mean, it's not surprising. I would think that Jim Harbaugh looks for every potential angle or, you know, avenue that he can take to get even the slightest advantage for his team. He must think this is one. But, you know, they went 8-5 last year, so he might want to try something.
Yeah, you might want to try something. The new rules this year, one of them is you can play up to 4 games, and it could be a combination of any 4 games and still maintain that year of eligibility. What were your thoughts when you saw that happen?
Well, another move that, you know, benefits two groups, and I think it benefits coaches, and you wouldn't think it does, but it does benefit coaches to a significant degree. And that's the ability to evaluate their true freshmen, to get a good look at them, to get an idea of where they are in their process or in their progress as players, and also just get guys experience for your system. You know, you can practice that whole redshirt year and run routes on a practice field on Tuesdays, but it's totally different to do it on a Saturday. So it will help guys acclimate to the game. That's good for programs, good for coaches. But obviously for players as well, you know, you get to miss that redshirt season. You get to, you know, not feel like you're not a part of the team. You start your clock. You get a little more experience. It's good for everybody. Again, and not to be a cynic about it and be jaded, but we do talk a lot about player safety. That's an extra 4 games on a student-athlete's body. That may be something that could be an issue or could be a topic that people want to address, but in general, I thought it was a positive move, a good rule change for everybody.
Does it put potentially some extra juice into the bowl season? Because every once in a while, a veteran like a Leonard Fournette or a Christian McCaffrey will forego the bowl game to get ready for the draft. Does it put potentially more juice into a bowl game if you have a series of guys that have played 3 games and that fourth one would be the bowl game?
Yeah, for sure. And that's really fascinating. What's also interesting to think about is, like, what about the other 3 games, right? Let's say you're Ohio State or you're Penn State, and you have a top 5 recruiting class coming in. No matter what, even if you've got great depth, you're going to play 10 to 12 of them just because they're too good to keep off the field. What about those other 10 guys or those other 8 guys that you would have played in another environment? What if when Penn State plays Ohio State or Penn State plays Michigan, you can roll out 6 of those guys, and they'll help you on special teams, they'll be there for depth, they'll return a kick, they'll do whatever. They'll be ready for a certain package. That's a major advantage. So for schools like Penn State, Ohio State, that recruit at a high level, you know, your USC, whomever, it's a real advantage just for the game that you need them for. And certainly bowls would be one of them. I didn't think about the fact that you could replace your outgoing NFL guy, but that's a really good point. You know, when you lose a McCaffrey or a Fournette, or one day you're going to lose a QB going into a bowl game, maybe you have a guy that you can plug into play, and it's not, you know, the Rose Bowl. It's a Citrus Bowl, and you roll with the punches knowing that the experience will help them out next season.
The transfer rule, again, and this is not a let's hit a Jim Harbaugh thing. I mean, let's face it, that's the area with him I've been most surprised at, that he hasn't been able to recruit and groom a quarterback. He's been able to exist on transfers. Rudock, Okorn, of course, from Houston didn't really pan out too well, but now he's got Shea Patterson. You and I both know, Paul, that when it comes to college basketball, there's 700 to 800 transfers a year. It's like the waiver wire in April and May. The new transfer rule says they can just walk in and say, look, I'd like a transfer, and within 48 hours, beginning October 15th, they have to be put on the list in the database. What did you think of that?
Now, transfers are a major topic among coaches. I mean, I've heard coaches call them things like an epidemic because transfers are rising so much. I wrote a story a couple weeks ago about the kind of death of the career backup quarterback in college, and there's only 7 senior QBs in Division I FBS who are seniors, who are on scholarship and haven't transferred despite not starting a game. You know, there's no guy who just stays for 3 or 4 years and sticks around. So it's an issue. But I do think this kind of an issue in the sense that it does impact programs. What I'm interested in thinking about moving forward with the new transfer rule is, will it really lead to an uptick and this great increase in transfers? I'm not totally sold that it will. I mean, people could always have transferred before, and if you had the opportunity, just because you couldn't transfer from Alabama to Georgia doesn't mean that you couldn't transfer and play somewhere else. So I don't think it'll lead to a rise in transfers. I think it'll make things easier for everybody. So I think that schools such as, you know, in the SEC most of all, but even in other conferences, it makes things ugly, and it makes things difficult for everybody when you put out the list that says, oh, you can't transfer here, 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 here's where you can. It's not a good look for the school. It doesn't help the player. So I think that gets that out of the way, and that's just good. I think that's a solid move forward.
I think the one that really caught everyone's attention was Bo Ryan a few years ago when transfer tried to get out of there, and he put down, 26 schools he couldn't go to?
Eventually
he ended up transferring to Iowa, and he had a great career, so.
Yeah, I mean, that's just crazy, and that shouldn't happen. You know, and guys, some programs are good about it. You know, some programs will say, best of luck, we'll help you on your way out the door. Other programs aren't. And, you know, like we said with injury reports, make it uniform and make it consistent, and it's easier rules for everybody to follow. You'll see less rule breaking and tampering that way.
All right, you mentioned rules, Paul. Here's one that's a game rule, and that is the kickoff rule, where you can fair catch it inside the 25, and it's brought out to the 25-yard line as if it were a touchback. What was your thought when you saw that?
Well, you know, they put this new come out to the 25 rule in a few years back. It's been fine. I mean, it changed the game a little bit, but, you know, not noticeably different in my mind. One thing that teams started to try to do, and a lot of coaches, special teams coaches, would just work at it, was trying to get that lofty kick that would go up at the 2-yard line with enough hang time, or getting out to the 25 wasn't a sure thing or even close to a sure thing. I hate that they're removing the strategy from it, because I do think strategy and those kind of things are kind of what makes football more than just unique, kind of makes it bring some thinking into the game, and I'll miss that. But on the other hand, not to harp on it, we talk about player safety again. This is why they make these moves. That's the total impetus behind it. I hate that it removes the strategy, but I do sense and see where they're coming from. And again, we'll get used to it and we'll just kind of adapt, but it will be a noticeable difference, I think, for those first couple of weeks, certainly for fans tuning in and expecting a return from the 5 or something.
You know what, though, Paul? You and I are both around players. You put a running back, a receiver back there. He's the lone guy back there. He thinks he's going to make the play. I think we're going to see a handful of these, and it's probably going to be like an up guy that's a blocker. I mean, that's my opinion. I mean, it's a guess, but my opinion.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, running backs and receivers are the same way. They want the ball. So if they're going to, like, kick it to a guy at the 2, the idea that they're just going to be like, all right, let's take a knee or whatever, that doesn't make any sense, because guys are going to want to take a shot, because everyone thinks when they have the ball in their hand that they're about to score a touchdown. At the same time, I do think that teams are going to take advantage of it, you know, and I think that's going to be more about the kick that, you know, is along the sideline, or the one that, you know, kind of gets caught at the 12 with a lot of hang time and you just don't want to take the chance. You'll see a lot of those as people get more and more comfortable, but I would hate to see no one return it at all inside the 25. I mean, I hate the idea that would be removed entirely. I mean, that's too much.
I agree with you, but yet I look at the Alliance of American Football, the spring league that will start in February, and their rules include starting at the 25-yard line, no kickoff. In fact, I don't even think they have extra points. They'll have two-point conversions. Is there a thought
really
in your
unique
mind that down the road a few years from now that's the trend we'll see?
Yeah, I do. And I mean, you're seeing it in incremental kind of steps and a process, but I do think we're headed in that direction where, you know, if this is how you start, where you're trying in a subtle way to cut down on kickoffs. The next step, obviously, is just to cut them down entirely. What's next, though? You know, I'm 100% all for making player safety the number one focus and concern for college football, because it's how you ensure
Absolutely.
That the game will definitely survive. Mm-hmm. But when do you stop? You know, this isn't about, like, defensive backs using their hands too much. Like, this is a rule change that kind of steps on top of each other and leads to one thing after another. I just don't know where you draw the line. And that being said, if you want to remove kickoffs, fine. But let's not dramatically or definitively change the game that we play, because that's kind of why we appreciate it.
Right. I see exactly where you're going with this. When the Supreme Court, I don't think it was a surprise. I knew New Jersey, you know, you and I both know New Jersey had lost it every step of the way, but for some reason I think the gut feeling was they were going to win at the Supreme Court level on a states' rights issue, which they did. When it finally did get the 6-3 vote, what was your first thought about it?
Well, I mean, your first thought from my college sports perspective was just the profound impact this is going to have going forward. I think the NCAA has made anti-gambling, rightfully so, one of its hallmark messages to student athletes, in addition to, you know, not cheating, no drugs, no gambling. It kind of fits into what the NCAA has been about in terms of their amateur model for decades. But this is a floodgate moment, you know, and there's too much money to be made in gambling for sports leagues and the NCAA to take a step back and say, well, go have at it. It's just not going to happen. So I think what you'll see certainly in like the near future as it becomes more and more prevalent, like we said, maybe the next 5 years is, you know, you'll see championship events held in Las Vegas. And you'll see a championship event held in Delaware, where they removed them because of where Delaware had stood on legalized sports gambling. And you'll see just an acceptance of it, that it's a way of life. I don't think you'll open up NCAA.com or NCAA.org and be taken to, oh, the NCAA has your lines and here's your gambling website. I don't think we'll go that far, but you're going to see a seismic change. And it's certainly seismic change in how we cover the sport, because it doesn't have to be whispered about for a lot of people. You can say it out loud. And for a lot of people, that Tua Tagovailoa at the quarterback for Alabama, hey, that's really important. But what do you think about -13.5? That's the big thing. So certainly will also change the way the media covers the sport. For better or worse, I think it will have an impact.
Have you thought in your own style about how you will or will not incorporate that into stories? Or is it going to be on a case-by-case basis?
You know, I think for a lot of people, you got to sit back and think about every week doing something about it, you know, and writing about it, because like I said, it's an important part of the game. That's an important part of the game when you're not even, you know, in a work setting. You know, you're sitting at a bar with your friends, or you're, you know, in line at the grocery store. It's a conversation piece. So I do think it's an important thing for everybody to cover, because there is a national interest in it. Obviously you wouldn't pick the games, or I wouldn't pick on the games myself, because I'd lose, but also because it would be probably a little bit wrong. But I do think that you know, you have to include it in your coverage, because it's what people are going to be talking about. The ability to do that is, again, I don't know if we can really explain it, just how big it is to be able to have this out in the open rather than, you know, just kind of on the tertiary or the outside of the game.
Yeah, because my thought process has been, the guys that, and the men and women that have been gambling on games for years, whether it's Nevada or offshore, they're just going to keep doing what they've been doing. Now, maybe they'll do it in a state level as opposed to offshore. We'll see. But it's going to be, right, to me, the person that wants to go 10, 25, 50, 100, 500 on a game that hadn't done it before, didn't know how to do it, or avenue now could do it. I think that's going to be the difference maker. That, at least that's my opinion.
Yeah, for sure. It makes the casual person, it like opens it up to the casual person, you know, and the casual guy who thinks he knows who's going to beat the Yankees and the Blue Jays is going to throw a little down. Hey, you know, I can do it. I can go on the internet. I don't need to go to some strange, you know, Eastern European website to do this. I can just go on the internet and throw $500 down. So I think that is an opener for a lot of people. And I can't even imagine the money that's going to pour in. It's going to be in the hundreds of millions of dollars on sports gambling every year when this goes even past 7 states, when it gets to 10 or 15. The money is going to be unbelievable.
Yeah, I think in 5 years it's going to be 30 plus. But again, I don't go to strange European sites. I go usually to USA Today.
So I gave myself away. I don't either. I was trying to think, how could I say it? I don't want to be rude to any individual country, so I kind of made it generic. But you know what? And it's honest, I have never gambled on sports. That's predating I've never done it in my life. And I don't think I ever would, because I know how fickle this sport is and how impossible it is to bet. I mean, how can you really know if North Texas is going to lose to Georgia by more than 21 points? How could you know?
We don't. Now, I do teach a sports broadcasting class at Penn State on top of my other duties. And I've told them, I said, look, when it comes to gambling, do whatever you want. I've always told them that. Do whatever you want. I said, but don't gamble a dime on the game you're covering.
Yeah. Definitely don't do that, because there's a line there that you don't want to cross professionally. That would, I mean, because clearly, like, you're covering a game and it's -3 and they get a field goal in the final second and they win 17-13. I mean, that's not going to bleed into how you cover the game.
Right.
I mean, come on.
Right. I mean, it skews either way. Say they win, you're too euphoric about what you just saw, or if it goes the wrong way, you're too negative about what you saw.
Right. Don't do that. I would suggest to your students the same. And if they go to Penn State, they're already headed for greatness. Don't gamble on sports. Don't do that. That's just bad.
Hey, Paul, thanks so much. Have a great holiday. I really appreciate the fact you gave us time today. And on short notice, too. We really appreciate it.
Of course. Yeah, have a great 4th, everybody listening. And I hope to talk to you again soon.
Hope so, Paul. Outstanding Paul Meyerberg, college football writer, USA Today. We'll come back, final half hour. We're going to talk more about this topic, also about a great article is written about Andy Russell. They see it the way we see it. The heck with how many Steelers were in the Hall of Fame. He should be in the Hall of Fame. This goes back to a conversation Jack and I had when we were driving back from Maryland together, and we talked about this. You know, and believe me, if I mention Andy Russell's name to Jack, he'll wax poetic about the kind of player Andy Russell was and the kind of guy, too, which everyone in our area knows. Fritz knows it better than anybody. We'll come back with more in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK, brought to you by our good friends at Sunbury Motors. When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Sunbury Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC way. The choice is up to you. The other guy's way or the SMC way? The SMC way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. News Radio 1070 WKOK, your home for the Philadelphia Phillies, who swing you back into action tonight at 7:05, 6:30 the airtime as they take on the Baltimore Orioles. Zach Eflin goes tonight for the Phillies. He's 6-2 with a 3.02 ERA, and Alex Cobb will go tonight for the Orioles at 2-9 with a 6.75 ERA. Cobb in 74 and two-thirds innings has given up 104 hits. That is a huge number. 104 hits and 74 in the third innings. Wow. That's now, it's also Manny Machado's playing there tonight. Machado's had himself quite a year. 21 home runs, 59 knocked in, and he's hitting .310. So despite everything that's gone wrong for the Orioles, who right now are, you know, 35 games under .500. It's 35 games under .500. Machado's having an awesome year. 21, 59, .310. Wow. You have to think about it. It's awfully tempting. The problem is the one area of baggage that comes into play here with Machado, it is the contract. It is up at the end of the year. So you are risking rental versus long-term solution. I know in reading articles, the Orioles evidently really like J.P. Crawford. No offense. I know they traded Freddie Galvis to San Diego because of Crawford. I think Crawford in the field is very good. I think Crawford at the plate is a liability. Question is, can you sign him? That's the question. But give Zach Eflin credit, Judge. Zach Eflin's been really good for them. Really good.
Yeah, 5-for-5 in the month of June, and bullpen just doing enough, especially on these home games, to really make a dent here in the NL East, and they're firmly entrenched in second place and in a great spot right now. You know, there's still many, many more games to go, but we'll see where they go from here.
Except here's the part they didn't expect. I think they expected to go into tonight down 2.5 games, right? 2.5 games. Except the Braves beat the Yankees. Wow. That's not quite what you expected, is it? I give them all. I give the I give the Braves all the credit in the world.
I think there are many, many baseball fans out there that absolutely underestimated what Atlanta has been able to do here in the first half of the season.
I just kept waiting for the Atlanta bubble to burst over and over and over again.
That could still happen, just with the fact of being such a long season and so many ebbs and flows and ups and downs. You think a little, you know, hiccup could be on the horizon. You know, maybe after the All-Star break, they may, you know, be a little flat toward the end of July.
They're playing really well.
I would think they would want to. I think they'd want to keep playing and not take a break.
You find a lot of teams get into that boat, but you know what? You do need rest. I mean, guys do get tired. There's no getting around it. You do get tired. But, I mean, Eflin's a guy they picked up from the Padres. And you know what? He's worked his way through the system. And you could almost tell really at Reading. When he went to Reading in 2015, he was 8-6 with a 3.69. I mean, that's pretty good in 23 starts on the AA level. That's good. That's good pitching. You know, and now, look, this particular season with the Phillies, he's been a big plus for them. And you look at Cobb. Now, Cobb's been a really good pitcher in his career. I mean, he's not a Hall of Famer, but he's been good, you know, when he was at Tampa Bay. But now, 104 hits in 74 and two-thirds? That's astronomical. But you got to think about Machado. And it's a hard decision. And he's made it a hard decision because his contract's up at the end of the year. He's a free agent. Now, you can wait it out if you want. See how Crawford plays the rest of the year, and then, like everybody else, you can bid for Machado in the offseason. You can do that. But the Orioles, according to Ken Rosenthal's article in The Athletic, seems like they're fielding and evaluating offers now. Okay. But that article you sent me about Andy Russell, we've talked about this. Andy Russell has been, obviously, what he's done to help out the community, Sealands Grove, it's been tremendous. He and his wife have really done great work, put their name and money behind great causes in our area that have helped out. I mean, they're like direct help to so many in the community. But he was a terrific football player for the Steelers. You know, and when Chuck Noll passed away, we had him on the show, and he was one of only five guys that survived the Bill Austin era into the Chuck Noll era. He's one of only five from the last year of Bill Austin, the first year of Chuck Noll. And he tells the story that Noll got up in front of the team and he said, I've looked at the tapes, I know exactly what's wrong. He says, you're not very good. And Andy said that Chuck Noll told him to make an adjustment with his feet. And I want to say the adjustment was like 2 inches. Does that sound right, Sean? A 2-inch adjustment in his feet.
Very minuscule, yes.
He said, trust me, this will make you a better player, a better linebacker. And, of course, Andy's like, what are you talking about? But, of course, Andy did what Chuck Noll said, and he says, I couldn't believe it. The guy was exactly right. Well, Jack Ham will talk about the various influences, you know, great influences he had in his career that got him to the Hall of Fame. Dan Radakovich certainly would be one. There's no question, Dan Radakovich. But when he got to the professional level, and of course, Bad Rad then, of course, went to the Steelers. But Andy Russell. There are certain guys, you know, and Jack will tell you how much Andy Russell helped teach him the pro game. You know, that take you under your wing kind of guy. And this is back when organizations were a little bit different back then. Back in the day, of course, you know, all those Steelers, Joe Green, L.C. Greenwood, Dwight White, Jack Ham, Jack Lambert, Andy Russell, Lauren Taves, Mel Blount, Mike Wagner. They stayed there for decades. Nobody went free agent because there was no free agency. So nobody did it. So for the good of the team, you take guys under your wing. You know, of course, Andy and Jack played on the opposite side, so there's no threat of a job or anything like that. But you know, Jack will tell you, Andy Russell taught him a lot about playing NFL linebacker. Okay. Well, now the argument about the Hall of Fame. One of the more ridiculous arguments that I hear on any Hall of Fame selection in any sport is, quote, there are too many of. So let's keep this in an NFL mode. There are too many 1960s Green Bay Packers. We had Jerry Kramer on the Friday before the Super Bowl, which was the day before they announced the Hall of Fame. The next day, Jerry got into the Hall of Fame. And that's why when I see a Terrell Owens, I know I'm going to go on a tangent for a moment. When I see a Terrell Owens going to make his Hall of Fame speech at his college and not in Canton, because I think he feels snubbed that it took, what, 3 years to get in? You know, would you like to sit down with Jerry Kramer and ask him how much he cherishes it after four decades? And Jerry Kramer, in my opinion, should have been in the Hall of Fame years ago. We all have our different opinions, but I thought Jerry Kramer was a heck of a player. And not just because of the block on the goal line against Dallas. Jerry Kramer played really well his entire career. But the argument was, geez, there's so many Green Bay Packers. I mean, you already got Forrest Gregg and Bart Starr and Paul Hornung and Jim Taylor and Willie Davis and Dave Robinson, you know, Herb Adderley. You keep going on all the Packers from the 60s that are in the Hall of Fame, including Vince Lombardi. I mean, do we need another one? You hear that argument. That's ridiculous. When it comes to the Hall of Fame, the Hall of Fame is on individual merit, regardless of name of team. Now, obviously, winning championships accentuates the profile. I understand that. That's why you look at the 1970s Minnesota Vikings. There aren't a lot of the 1970s Minnesota Vikings in the Hall of Fame. They lost four Super Bowls in the 1970s. I realize it was the 69 season. Super Bowl IV was in 1970. So, I mean, they lost four Super Bowls in the 70s. And they don't have that many players. And it's kind of a big deal that Mick Tinglehoff, the center, got in. You know, and obviously Alan Page is in, people like that. But they didn't get a lot of guys in to the Hall of Fame. So I know that winning does sway how you're viewed. That's why it was the Boogie Cousin thing that we talked about with Dieter Kurtenbach is so interesting. Is our opinion of him going to be different as a player, should the Warriors win next year, and he is an important part of it? I think that's an interesting question to ask now. Now let's bring it back to Andy Russell. There's so many Steelers from the 70s in the Hall of Fame. My goodness, you got Bradshaw, you got Harris, you got Swan, you got Webster, you got Stallworth, you got Ham, you got Mel Blount, you got Joe Green. No. And so there are too many Steelers. It has nothing to do with how many are from one group in. It's individual. And to me, Andy Russell can stand side by side because I've watched him play. This is not somebody reading articles and saying that Andy Russell should be in based on what I've read or out based on what I read. This is, I watched him play. He was really, really good. Really good. Did I think he was Hall of Fame good when I was watching him? Yeah, I thought he was Hall of Fame good when I was watching him. Problem is, time, like with Jerry Kramer, passes and passes and passes. And so the interview I did with Jerry, which you heard last week on our Best Of series, you know, I was able to talk to him about certain elements when he played, which I think he appreciated because I saw him play. And that helps when you're talking to some of these guys and you saw them play and you're interviewing them. Now, we've had, you know, Jerry on the show. He made it. Andy, of course, has been on the show several times. But he should get there. And this argument, it's archaic. Too many Yankees in the Hall of Fame. There are too many Packers in the Hall of Fame. There are too many Steelers in the Hall of Fame. There are too many Celtics in the Hall of Fame. Too many. In fact, in the NHL, you never hear there are too many Montreal Canadiens. You never hear that. And in the NBA, you never hear there are too many Celtics. Or Lakers. You never hear there are too many Lakers. But you do hear in football there are too many fill in blank. Now, we haven't quite heard yet too many 49ers. I think Roger Craig should be in. It's just me. I think Roger Craig should be in. I think when it comes to the Packers, I think of that era, Jerry Kramer is the one guy I've always felt strongly should be in. But there's nobody else from that team any longer that I look at and would put in that category. With the Steelers, Andy Russell's one of those guys. And with the 49ers, again, a guy I look at is Roger Craig. I think he ought to be in, too. Now, I know it's not easy. It's not easy to do this. Because there are only X amount of selections. Now, you're talking, right now, 32 teams, 45 guys each team. That's a lot of players that you run through. That's a lot of players you run through. Tony and Shamokin, how are you, my friend? Great to hear you again.
Oh, it's been a while. How about Alex Karras?
Alex Karras should be in, too, from what he did with the Detroit Lions, because I thought he had a great career. And it's interesting how Paul Hornung was never really penalized in terms of the Hall of Fame thought for his suspension for gambling, but you always felt Alex Karras might have been.
I thought Alex Karras should have been in, and I don't think it's Paul Hornung because he played for the Packers. I think it's because he played for Notre Dame.
Well, it's the Pro Football Hall of Fame. I think if Peter King was on here, I think he'd tell you differently.
That has something to do with it. And how about the 58? I don't know if you ever heard this story. It goes with gambling Hall of Fame. The 58 Giants Colts game. Remember that game called the greatest ever?
Oh, I mean, okay. When the 58 game with the Giants and Colts was played, I was a week away from my first birthday, so I've seen tape.
You've heard about the game, right?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. The overtime game, Alan Ameche, Johnny Unitas, Raymond Berry, all the way Charlie Connerly, everybody. Frank Gifford.
That was a 4-point line on that game. The Colts had a first down on a 1-yard line. All he had to do was kick a field goal to win it. But Cal, I believe, that's why they ran for the touchdown.
That's interesting.
If they had kicked the field goal, what would Rosenblum have got? A trophy.
Well, you wouldn't receive a trophy, but you know what? You and I both know that field goal kicking in that era, look at the stats, not exactly of today.
All right, you don't kick, you don't make it to the 1-yard line. Where the Giants going to go with that cold defense at that time to get the ball back? Do it again.
No, I know. I understand what you're saying, but I just can't imagine Johnny Unitas, who called all the plays, sitting back thinking.
I could imagine Johnny Unitas. Them guys didn't make that much money.
No, they did not make that much money, no.
I mean, that wouldn't surprise me. I remember the Eagles used to scrimmage down at Hershey Park Stadium.
Yep.
And at halftime, you'd see the players come out back. You know, they'd be down there by the locker room. There's Johnny Unitas. Well, I remember Joe Scarpatti from the Eagles. Yep. There was a couple, and they're all out together in the back. They all had a cigarette and a beer.
Yeah, there's that famous photo of Len Dawson at halftime of Super Bowl I smoking a cigarette with in the locker room.
But there's, I mean, yeah, but, you know, Alex Karras, the guy, he was a heck of a player for his time on the team he played for. And who was the
linebacker?
He was
a dominant player that was the number one guy that you had to take care of in the Detroit Lions defense. And he really was a terrific NFL player.
What guy from the Packers used to take care of him pretty good was Jerry Kramer.
Jerry Kramer took care of a lot of people. That's why I always felt for years he should have been in, and I felt very strongly about his candidacy. That's why I was thrilled we got him on the show.
Was there, who was the linebacker on that Detroit Lions team? Joe Schmidt?
Joe Schmidt was the middle linebacker.
Is he in the Hall of Fame?
Joe Schmidt, I believe, is in the Hall of Fame, and Yale Larry.
Yale Larry, safety. I remember that guy.
Yeah, his safety and punter is in the Hall of Fame as well.
Yeah. I mean, you don't see too many Detroit Lions in the Hall of Fame.
And they haven't won since the 50s. I mean, that's the issue.
That's
They won championships in the 50s. I mean, Bobby Lane, for example, is in. Dick Nitrane Lane is in. Len Barney. Now, from later era, like Len Barney's in. We've had Len Barney on the show before, too.
Wasn't Milt Plum from Penn State, didn't he quarterback them for a few years?
Yeah, Milt Plum was their quarterback. He had been with the Browns, then he went to the Lions, and yeah, Penn State's Milt Plum for many years quarterbacked the Detroit Lions in the early to mid-60s.
Boy, them names we mentioned, what are there, about 30 of us out here that know who we're talking about?
That's probably right. I was doing a Spikes game last night on radio, and I started talking about, because the cover of the Cardinals media guide is looking back at the 50th year of Bob Gibson's 1.12. And so I was going through Kurt Flood and Lou Brock, and I was talking about Gibson, how they won in 67. And I looked over to the writer's box, and it was almost like I was speaking a foreign language.
That's like when you talk about the old Eagles and you mentioned PTOs. I mean, who? What?
Hey, let's talk about Tom Wudishek and Pete Retzlaff.
Pete Retzlaff, number 44, eh?
Yeah. Wide out,
hey,
Pete
listen,
Retzlaff.
You guys have a great 4th of July. It was nice talking to you again.
Tony, complete pleasure. Thanks so much. Happy 4th.
Yep. Same here, bud. Bye.
All right, happy 4th to each and every one of you. We'll wrap it up in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Have a great, happy, wonderful, enjoyable 4th of July. Be safe. Be safe where you're traveling. Be safe at the parties. Enjoy fireworks. Coming up on Thursday's show, former Nittany Lion linebacker Jason Kabinda. We try to make sure that the hits keep on coming. Our thanks to Dieter Kurtenbach on the NBA, Paul Meyerberg of USA Today on college football. Check it out on the Steve Jones Show podcast. Sean, happy 4th to you, my friend. Please enjoy.
We will. Thank you. Hit him long and straight tomorrow with your son.
That's right. It's not on Sportsbook. Nor should it be.
Or could be on YouTube.
I hope not.
You're listening to News Radio 1070 WKOK Sunbury. You can hear us anywhere in the world with the Sunbury Broadcasting Corporation app.